Hi, today is August 8, 2015. This is Mobile Views Podcast number 126. I'm Todd Ogasawara with... Who is that anyway? Oh, it's John Westfall.
Yeah, wherever he was. I will say I was very flattered that you did mention me in my absence. I won't say that I listened to some of the podcasts just to hear if I was mentioned or if I was forgotten about, but... Yeah, I was on a two-week adventure where I left my home in Mississippi and went up to visit family and friends in Ohio and Pennsylvania. Went to Pennsylvania for my brother-in-law's wedding and got a lot of interesting perspective on where technology has taken us now when we travel and where it still sorely lacks keeping us well connected.
Yeah, so for the vast majority of this podcast, I expect we're going to be talking about our travel, what's the word I'm going to look for? Our accumulated travel knowledge over the last couple of weeks. I was away for a week, not quite, only half as long as John, but I share some of his enthusiasm for this topic. But before we get started, I want to thank our good friends Frank McPherson and Sven Johansson. Two of the only people whose names are as long as mine.
yes, they took good care of you while I was gone.
For sitting in with me, bearing with me for 2 weeks in a row while John was absent, and we will have them back again when their schedules permit, as well as Jack Cook and some other friends of ours that we'd like to have on and talk about. But anyway, so John, I was gone for 1 week. Left on a Sunday, came back on a Saturday a couple weeks ago, went to San Diego for a conference, very good conference. And you were away for 2 weeks. Now, when you say you're literally on the road, you drove all this time, right?
Yep. So we left Mississippi. We drove about 14 hours up to Ohio.
Wow.
And then we're there for a few days. Then we drove down to Pittsburgh. And then we were there for about a week. And then drove back down to Mississippi. So full day drives on either end, half day drive in the middle. And yeah, it was on the road. I lived out of one bag, which one of my notes later will talk about how that is to live out of just one bag.
Okay. And you travel with your wife, or I assume you're traveling with your wife?
Yep. So we had we actually took a lot of things with us here and there. We had things that had to go up to the wedding, and we ended up bringing some stuff back down that had been in storage. So that's probably why I only took one bag, because the car was pretty well packed.
Yeah.
But while I was on the road, I did bring a full complement of devices. I had my phone, I had two iPads, my full size and my iPad mini, and my MacBook.
Wow.
Yeah, well, you know, I never quite know what I'm going to need where I'm at. My first point that actually I had to talk about was that this is becoming a lot more coherent as better synchronization tools and things like Handoff and the iOS ecosystem work fairly well. So I could, you know, grab my phone and bum around the house or around the places we were at. And then if I wanted to, drop the phone back off somewhere, grab the iPad. And if I had to get work done, grab the computer and not really feel like I needed any of the other devices for any particular reason. If a phone call came in, it would go through to any device. Text messages would go through any device. So that's one thing I will say that we've kind of gotten in the last couple of years that I don't think we fully appreciate, that when you're walking around on vacation and you go, oh, I need to get my computer for this, you know, task, you could leave the phone and tablet and just grab the computer and walk back to where you were.
Yeah, I should point out, though, you are in a 100% Apple ecosystem, right? I
mean, that is true.
iPhone, iPad, MacBook.
Although I was syncing to Google Photos during this trip as well.
Yep.
So that there were some interesting things. I shot about 200 photos the day of and the day before the wedding. Mm-hmm. So that is something we can talk about, what you do when you have cell phone data connection and 200 photos that you're trying to manage.
Oh, yeah, that's a problem. That's a problem.
But one thing that's even worse problem is Verizon doesn't have Wi-Fi calling yet.
Mm.
And where my in-laws live, they don't get Verizon service in their house.
Wow, that's rare.
Yeah, they are in a little valley, and if you go outside the house, or if you go to certain rooms in the house, you can get like a bar and get and receive text messages and send text messages. But that was one thing that I thought, why hasn't Verizon jumped on with everyone else yet and implemented this?
So have you given, I mean, this is another show, probably, but another episode, but have you given some thought to going to Google Fi?
I have, but all my current generation devices, I mean, I don't have any other current phone devices, so I'd have to buy a new phone device.
Well, for Google Fi, it only works with the Nexus 6, so.
Yeah, that's true. So I'd have to buy
a Nexus. It doesn't work with anything I have either.
Have you nearly gotten close to that, or have you gotten your new invite yet? I know
it's
during the saga.
Yeah, as people who listen to podcasts may recall, I actually did get an invitation a few months ago, actually. But I couldn't accept it because of the changes it would make to my existing Google Voice account, which are unacceptable to me because of the way I use it. And so I created a second Gmail account and created a, requested an invitation for it. But, you know, I'm not an expert in nuclear technology, but it seems to me, you know how everybody says nuclear fusion is like 30 years out or 10 to 30 years in the future? And every time you ask them that, no matter what, how many years ago you asked them, if you asked them 10 years ago, asked them now, it's still 10 to 30 years in the future.
Yep.
A Google Fi invitation is kind of like that. You know, my invitation has been 3 to 4 weeks from now for weeks now. It doesn't change.
It'll just show up one day.
Yeah. So I'm still waiting to do that. And it, for me, it won't be too jarring, I think, once I get this whole, you know, make sure it doesn't kill my Google Voice account thing straightened out. Because I'm already on T-Mobile, so I'm just going to move T-Mobile to Fi, which is a combination of T-Mobile and Sprint. So, you know, from my point of view, my coverage will be the same, if not a little better.
Mm-hmm.
So that'll be okay. And it will have Wi-Fi calling. I mean, basically, you know, it hops on Wi-Fi whenever it can to, you know, save itself probably network costs as an MVNO to those who existing carriers.
Yeah, right now, the only time I don't have Verizon coverage is the about 10 days a year that I'm at my in-laws between Christmas and other trips. So It's not as big a deal as it could be. And with Google chopping features out of Google Voice as they have been, or cannibalizing Google Voice, I'm also very leery about what I would do with Google Fi or how I'd use it. So For now, I will just say Verizon, just get on the ball and get Wi-Fi calling, and I'll be happy.
Okay. And speaking of your connectivity issues, so what's up with cloud storage and stuff? How was that? How did that work out for you?
Well, we don't realize that our cloud storage providers, Dropbox, OneDrive, Google Drive, Apple Photos, Google Photos, all those things are not built to have either slow internet connections or not always on internet connections. So when you're traveling and you're just connecting here and there, I'll give an example. One night, my brother-in-law and soon-to-be sister-in-law came over and opened a wedding present that my wife had made for them, a blanket that she had been working on for a few months. And so I took video as they were opening it. You know, it was a nice little video. It took about 3 minutes. That night, we didn't really realize why the internet was having problems, but I realized the next morning that that video was getting uploaded to Apple Photos. And
it was
hogging up all of the available bandwidth.
Yeah. All 5 megabits up, or 1 megabit up, probably.
Yeah, exactly. And then if you couple that with, you know, Google Photos, I don't think it actually tried to upload to that at that point. But every time, you know, you turn on your laptop, Dropbox tries to grab a bunch of new things. OneDrive tries to grab a few things. And while OneDrive and Dropbox on the laptop have better bandwidth control, They still aren't really prepared for when you dump in a ton of photos that you took or something like that. So we take for granted that in little doses, these services work really, really well, but there's no good global pause button. So for example, CrashPlan that I use for my backups at home has a pause button that you can either hit pause or you can say pause for 1 hour, 1 day, something like that. It'd be really nice if those clients had the same sort of thing. And if iOS and Android had built in things like, hey, stop syncing this background service for a day, or stop syncing this for a couple of days, because I know I'm going to be dumping a bunch of stuff and I won't be back to a fast internet connection for a little bit.
Yeah, we really need some kind of a standard for these intensive, somewhat or potentially intensive background network processes like cloud storage, because, you know, with circumstances change, right? I mean, it's different when you're at home versus you're in an office versus you're in a hotel room or at, you know, a friend's home or your in-laws or whatever. And it needs to somehow know that, hey, I need to be able to adapt to this in a way that makes sense for the new environment I'm in.
I mean, it could be just as easy as if it hasn't connected in a couple days.
Right.
It realizes, hey, maybe I should pop up and ask the user, do you want me to try to sync all these files right now?
Right.
Should I limit the bandwidth for the next few hours? You know, what should I do because you haven't connected for a while?
Right.
But I think the bigger problem was just the background sync services that are, you can toggle them a little bit with Android. You can't toggle them at all with Apple. It's an all or nothing thing. That really can mess you up when you don't have the fast internet connections you're used to having.
Yeah, very true, very true. And you know, in fact, one of the things I've discovered is, you know, I, for whatever reason, I'm a cheapskate, whatever you want to call me, I keep a lot of old equipment around, and I keep it running. They're not just sitting there on a shelf somewhere. And so, you know, I've got old netbooks that I still run. I put one in at my mom's house, you know, that kind of thing. And I have found that, generally speaking, the second thing I do after uninstall Chrome to get back some performance is I start uninstalling synchronization software that I may not need on that device.
Yep.
Like, do I really need OneDrive? Maybe not. Do I really need Google Drive? Maybe not. Do I need Dropbox? Maybe not. And each one you drop not only reduces network resources, you know, the going up and down, which, you know, helps a little bit, but more importantly, it helps, it eliminates that background process running that network synchronization.
Yep.
And that, it turns out, can be processor intensive on these older devices. So,
yeah, I kind of am sad that I have to live in a world now where I use both OneDrive and Dropbox. I used to use just Dropbox, and then I decided to be really cheap. I had a bunch of OneDrive storage, so I moved some stuff over there.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely. I used to have all the sync services. Now I've cut back many of them, even on my primary machine, just to avoid the excess use.
Yeah. I'm with you there. I've eliminated a lot of things. It does seem to me that Dropbox is probably the most efficient of the major cloud sync storage type services that I'm aware of.
And definitely the most configurable to configure upload, download, that sort of thing, limiters and that sort of play nice with others ability.
Okay, so when you weren't fighting with bandwidth issues.
So there were some things that I was really grateful for. Podcasts, and you put on our show notes, audible.com. I used to use Audible years ago. We don't realize how much free and low-cost content there is out there.
Mm-hmm.
So this is really well when you're driving with someone else and they want a nap and you want something to keep yourself interested and occupied.
Mm-hmm.
You can listen to something. There are some long-form podcasts out there that are longer than we talk even.
Right.
So hour and a half sorts of things.
Right. And something less jarring than, say, Metallica or, you know, Black Sabbath or something.
Yeah. You can only listen to music for so long. I like listening to music, but, you know, you need something that's a little bit different. I started using Swarm again recently because mayorships came back. Yes, Foursquare/Swarm made it fun again to check in. And the Apple Watch app for Swarm is very good. It's very quick. I can check in straight from my wrist.
Oh, nice.
And I picked up some mayorships along the way, so that was kind of fun. And I also have, through a service we've talked about in the past, If This Then That.
Yeah.
I have it set up where every time I check in, it records it to Evernote, so I have a nice little listing of where I've been. And even though I have an app that does that automatically in the background, it's nice that these are the things I'm selecting and saying, I was literally here, where the app sometimes gets it off by geofence or something like that and says I was somewhere I wasn't.
Right.
It's kind of my own curated, this is where I was at and this is what I was doing.
Right. And I'll admit, despite my, you know, my mock admonishment of you, I also used Swarm while I was in San Diego, mostly so I would remember where I was. You know, if somebody said, hey, where'd you eat or whatever, you know, and I can't remember the name even today. So I did use Swarm. I did become mayor of a burger joint in Gaslamp District.
Awesome.
But nowhere else. Yeah, but at home, I'm still boycotting Foursquare and Swarm. I'm still mad. As you know, I have long-term kind of issues, like, you know, with my spot watch and things. So
yes, I thought we were leaving that. I thought you were feeling better now that you had a smartwatch.
But, you know, so I'm still angry at Foursquare and Swarm for messing up my previous mayorships and my addictive-like behavior, my compulsive behavior.
Here's the strange thing about previous mayorships. There were a couple places I checked in that I hadn't checked in for a few years, and I was throwing out my wife as mayor.
Really?
These are like private residences and things like that. She hasn't started using Foursquare/Swarm again.
Yeah.
And so their little claim that they didn't restore any of the mayorships, maybe they weren't visible, but the client still remembers who was the previous mayor. So there's some strangeness to that. I also like, now speaking of those services, that wherever you're at, they also have the local municipality as a check-in option. So if there isn't an option for the particular place you're at, you can just check in and say, "Hey, I'm in, you know, this city or that city or something like that."
Right. Okay. Well, I'm still angry at Swarm and Foursquare, so I don't want to talk about them.
All right. Be angry.
No. But yeah, I did use it, and it wasn't bad. I still think the old Foursquare check-in was easier than Swarm. But
it probably depends on client. I mean, the Swarm one, I do like how flexible it is and how you can add the little emoticons and stuff like that. Those are kind of cute. So so let's see. Next up on my list, my digital life, I thought was surprisingly well organized for being on the road for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. Email got regularly checked. I didn't miss anything. Notifications were coming through, all of that. My analog life was still not that organized. I had some really bad examples of throw it in the bag syndrome. Mm-hmm. So when I got home trying to sort things out, that was kind of annoying. I mentioned earlier that I just took one bag. I had enough clothes that I figured I was going to be near laundry ability for a while, since I was at houses. I thought, you know, I'm not going to pack a bunch of clothes. So I just took one bag. Usually I travel with a suitcase or duffel bag and a laptop bag. Sure. I consolidated down. That was kind of a bad idea. There were times when I was going, you know, this is really getting stuffed, and I hope my MacBook isn't getting, you know, damaged by being in a weird spot or this and that. So if you are trying to be a minimalist like I try to do, and you think, maybe I could just ditch the laptop bag and go down to one bag, unless you are not taking much at all, unless it's an overnight or something like that, you probably want to take your regular laptop bag, or man purse, as I end up calling it, because that's what it ends up becoming. Just because you can ditch down to one doesn't necessarily mean you should.
Otherwise known as a MRSE.
Yes. Of course, male nurses have that as their moniker. So we have to be clear.
Well, how do you know that, actually?
Yeah, we're not carrying around male nurses. We're just carrying around
laptop bags. I didn't realize they were referred to that way. But in any case,
I tried to refer to it as a MRSE once, and I was corrected by a male nurse.
Okay, so I will not refer to it as such anymore.
Yeah. No,
but I will say this. You might recall a few years ago, Scotty Vest co-sponsored. I can't remember who their sponsor was. But I remember Scotty Vest was one of two sponsors that went around the world with no bags at all.
Yes, I do recall that.
And as
someone who uses Scotty Vest products, I can understand how you do that. Right. I'm not necessarily sure you want to do that.
Yeah, I mean, he was stuffing his vests and things with, you know, everything, underwear, his shirts, whatever, right? Cameras, passport. I saw him pack and I still don't understand. Oh, I would not be, I mean, I couldn't even fit a power strip in the Scotty Vest as good as it is.
I have done amazing things with Scotty Vests in my time with them, but I haven't quite gotten to that level.
Yeah.
I call a number of trips back from the MVP Summit where my Scotty Vest was a second carry-on bag. It just, you know, I remember TSA one time pulling out 8 Windows Mobile devices from my Scotty Vest because it have set off things as it went through the scanner, because who carries around 8 phones? And, you know, I remember directing them, saying, "Oh, yeah, there's a pocket over there. There's another pocket back there. There's a flap over there." And it took them 10 minutes to get it all apart. And then it took me about a minute to put it all back together. They kind of talked about that.
Oh, my gosh.
But yeah, you gotta be smart about packing. And even though you want to be a minimalist, sometimes if you need a bag, you need a bag.
Yeah, I mean, basically the way I was only gone half as long as you. I was not near a, I guess I was near a laundry somewhere, but I wasn't going to use it. I'm too lazy to do that during a conference.
Yep.
But I did take a regular size suitcase and a backpack, and a man bag, man purse, and I didn't carry a notebook. I just carried a iPad mini, not even a full size iPad. And my Android phone and my iPhone. And that was it for computing. No digital camera either, by the way. No digital camera.
One of my little hacks, if you do desperately want to carry less, is get a man purse that can convert from shoulder to crossbody to backpack.
Yep. I've got one that can be a large fanny pack or, you know, over the shoulder. Mine is from Eagle Creek. I really love the Eagle Creek stuff. They're reasonably affordable, you know, much more affordable than, say, the high-end Tumi stuff, which I also love, but, you know, it costs an arm and a leg. And very durable. I mean, I've still got stuff that's probably 20 years old now, and still looks good. Still looks fine.
Since I'm a paranoid person, my stuff is from PackSafe. which they make some pretty nice quality things. But I have had one of their bags now for 4 or 5 years that I keep coming back to. I have a rotating stable of bags. Mm-hmm. But they have one that's a little bit of a messenger bag. It looks like a purse. It really does. There's no way to talk about it otherwise. But it has backpack straps that kind of fold up in it. So if I'm walking somewhere long distance, it becomes a backpack. If it's light, I can just put it over the shoulder. And if it is heavy, I can use a crossbody and not put my shoulder out with it. So be smart about your bags.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not just putting your stuff in. It's how the heck are you going to carry it without hurting yourself for long periods of time?
Yeah, and how to keep it organized. You know, you fall into this trap of everything has its little spot when you first leave. Yeah. And then by the time you get home, you're just throwing things in pouches and bags. And, you know, if you want to not lose something, you kind of need to keep a bag that has enough space in it and you're not cramming things everywhere.
That is very true. Very true indeed. Okay, next up, one of my favorite topics, and that's keeping the juice flowing in your gadgets.
Yeah, you and I both had a little bit about this. You know, what do you do when you've got an 18-hour wedding day, pretty much, because you're going to be partying into the night, and people have to get up early that day to get ready.
Yeah.
And in my case, I had my iPhone 6 Plus. I had my digital camera that had an iFi card in it, and I wanted to transfer those iFi pictures over to the iPhone so I could post them and upload them and such. And the way I really just dealt with it was every time I was near a charger, of course, charging. And then once we were at the venue and the reception was started and all of that, I just put it on airplane mode for about 2 hours, 2-3 hours in the middle of the evening. And when we got back to the hotel that night, I think I had about 15% battery left. So if I had not done that couple of hours of airplane mode, I mean, I figured when I was sitting in a reception with pretty much all of my wife's family, there were pretty much no one to contact me that couldn't just walk over to me. So it seemed like a safe bet to throw it into airplane mode for a little bit. But it's always a struggle to keep everything charged up. My digital camera as well had to be charged up a few times because it has a GPS function and the GPS drains the battery.
Interesting. You know, I used when I do carry a camera, I carry a Canon PowerShot with a built-in GPS. And I have to say, this particular camera, it's an older model. I think it's like a 280SX or something like that. Actually, it doesn't kill the battery. I'm really surprised. And by not killing the battery, I mean, GPS isn't just on when the camera's on. I have it in data collection mode. So even when you press the power button off, it's actually still collecting, you know, your travels. And so later on, you can grab the data, throw it into Google Earth or something, and you know, see where you were, not just where you need photos. So that's kind of neat. My problem is really solely with my Android device. And, you know, the iPhone 6 Plus and the iPad Mini kept going all day long. And I used them pretty hard. The iPad Mini, for example, I used to not only to take notes during the conference, but to take photos of slides in the conference, which I was intermingling using, I think I was using the Notability, which is pretty good for snapping a photo, inserting it into your notes, and you know, taking text notes and keep going. And I was really using that all day with no power issues at all. My Android phone, my Nexus 4, on the other hand, I had to charge it every day during lunch. Mm-hmm. It just, and this has been a perennial problem for me, starting with the G1, the T-Mobile, original Android phone, which didn't last a half day doing nothing. I mean, you just put in your bag and it dies by lunch, which is why I returned it within the 2-week grace period. But I have never had any luck with battery life on Android phones. They just die when you just look at the phone and the screen off and the battery seems to drain. So
yeah, it is something that I think Android needs to work a little bit better at. iOS is getting better, I think, now that Apple is building into iOS 9 a more battery reserve mode that you can activate that will throttle it down and save more. So it's, you know, as we get more and more use out of our devices, the battery has to get bigger and bigger and more streamlined. There's just no way around it.
That said, you know, one of the things I've noticed over the last, I'm going to probably say last 4 or 5 years, you know, if you go back into 5 years to the beginning of the decade, 2010 or so, and you hop into an airport there, you know, you'd have to go look for where the janitorial staff plugs in their vacuum cleaner and things to find power. And now you can pretty much readily find, if not an AC outlet, a powered USB outlet in chairs at the gates and things. So it's not as much of a problem. Not all gates have them, but you know, many of the ones I've been to recently have them. And even the hotels have a lot more AC outlets. I was at the Hard Rock Hotel in San Diego, And I think there were like 4 or 5 AC outlets by the, you know, the desk near the television. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty good. And also there were a couple outlets near the, you know, near the lamp base by the bed. So even though I had a power strip, really I could have survived without one.
Yeah, I was at a Hampton Inn, and between the two beds in the room were 3 power outlets and 2 USB charging
That's
ports.
That's very nice, yeah.
I had a little USB travel power strip, one of the Belkin power strips that's got 3 outlets and 2 amp ports on it.
We carried the same one.
Yeah, and I just plugged that in because I already had all my chargers connected and everything back to it. But it was really nice to see that. I know my wife used the USB ports and the power adapter.
Yeah, and you know, the Hawaiian Airlines flight I took to San Diego, which was, I think it was Airbus, it had USB power on the seats. So I could just plug into the back of the seat in front of me. And, you know, keep charge of the tray down and things like that. So that was pretty handy. I've also noticed I've taken a couple of shuttles and trains, like Amtrak has had USB power on the trains I've been on. And there's a shuttle in Portland, whose name I can't remember. But it's a shuttle bus. And then I took like a 90-minute ride on it to get to where I was going to the airport. And it also had not only power, but Wi-Fi.
So that's nice.
It was slow Wi-Fi, but still Wi-Fi, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I'd at least get email and stuff, if not watch movies. So that was good.
Tell me about your hotel Wi-Fi experiences as of late, and I will tell you about mine.
Well, you know, it's so highly variable. It's hard to figure out. Like, some hotels either charge you extra, like $10 a night for Wi-Fi, or sometimes you can get a deal. Like, I was on, where was I? I think I was at one of my favorite places, actually. Oh, I know, Embassy Suites. Embassy Suites makes it very difficult for you to get Wi-Fi unless you sign up for it before you go. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to be it's part of Hilton chain, right? So if you're a Hilton Honors, you can sign in a certain way and do this and that and other thing. But if you're not, or even if you are, I think you need a certain number of points before you can get on. And then when you get on, it's not bad, but it's not exactly fast. It's, you know, maybe a couple of megabits down. And at the Hard Rock Hotel I was at, before everybody arrived, because I got there a little early, Wi-Fi was pretty good. I think it was 20 megabits down or something like that. But and this was a big techie conference, right? There were 16,000 people. Once all the other, you know, geeks got there, you know, these hotels are simply not set up for a geek fest.
Well, that is probably why I do not use hotel Wi-Fi, if at all possible. I was also at a Hilton chain. I was at a Hampton Inn, which is part of Hilton. And I looked at their Wi-Fi offerings and was quite humored by they had premium Wi-Fi, which I could pay for. Mm-hmm. Then they had complimentary Wi-Fi, which I knew was going to be bad, and so I didn't even go for that.
Yeah.
And then there were a bunch of other weird options where if I had certain points, I could upgrade to premium and all that.
Right.
You know, I have a lot of data in my Verizon data plan, so I just tether. And with it being so easy to tether my devices all to my laptop, and that working fairly seamlessly now after a number of years, they finally have got it mostly right. I just don't want to deal with hotel Wi-Fi anymore because it never works right.
Well, you know, I will say this also, and I think I've pointed it out in other podcasts, but it seems to me like the premium hotels are the ones that tend to charge extra for Wi-Fi or have bad Wi-Fi, where the more budget hotels like the Quintus or something like that, and, you know, some of those kind of hotels actually have pretty darn good free Wi-Fi. I mean, we're not talking really fast, but, you know, 4 or 5 megabits down, enough to watch, you know, YouTube or something.
Yeah, and I will agree. That's what I found as well, especially hotels in the middle of nowhere have really good Wi-Fi because no one else is using them.
Yeah, I guess so.
So that's always it, too. You know, the more popular places, the more people, the worse the Wi-Fi. But those smaller chains, that's one of the things they use to get people to come to them is, you know, we give you the free Wi-Fi. I can't imagine that the reason why the large chains keep charging for it is anything other than they can.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think that this is costing them a bunch in their infrastructure and they're trying to recoup the costs. They know that people who stay there typically have the money for it.
Right.
And they don't care to lose out on a little bit of money for internet access.
Right. And I should say that, although I think Hard Rock Hotel normally charges for Wi-Fi, I think because I was on a conference hotel, you know, one of those deals the conferences set up, they included Wi-Fi as part of my package, so I didn't have to, you know, pay extra to connect.
Yep.
But that said, you know, I agree with you. You know, my tendency now is to look at the more budget hotels because, A, you know, it's not like I spent all day in a hotel. I'm basically there to sleep. So, you know, I hardly even see the hotel. But when I am in it, I would like Wi-Fi, and the budget hotels tend to have pretty decent Wi-Fi.
Yeah, it's a weird world we live in where the more you pay, the less you get.
Yep. Now, you know, the last trip I took my normal power strip, I think like you did, but I recently bought a Gang, I guess that's what you call it, a Gang USB charger. It's got 6 USB ports. It's pretty small. It's about the size of, what is it about the size of? Maybe it's the size of an old-fashioned telephone, maybe a little bit, you know, like 2 telephones stuck together, like an iPhone 4 or something. So it's not very big. It's got a total of something like 60 watts, you know, distributed among the ports. You know, with like, I think like, what was it? Was it 20 amps? It was quite a bit. But each port, I think, is limited to 1500 milliamps, which is reasonable, right?
Yeah.
For, you know, phones or a tablet or something. So that, I just started playing with that. It will charge my iPad mini. I haven't tried a full size iPad, but will charge my mini, all the phones, no problem. Won't charge my watch because the Moto 360 doesn't, key charger, its wireless charger, is not unpluggable. But, you know, if I wanted to, you could buy an Energizer, some other key charger, and charge it in and use that. So, you know, I could do that if I really wanted to use it for everything. But I'm really beginning to like it. You know, I don't have to unplug things to make room on the power strip to plug something weird in. You know, it's something you boot up only once a month and you got to charge it kind of thing.
Yep.
So really recommended. I know some of our mutual friends bought the Anker model, A-N-K-E-R, which is a pretty popular power kind of accessory company, USB chargers and Gang chargers and those sort of things. The one I bought is, interestingly enough, a company I never heard of called Fotiv. It was on sale at Views from a number of people, and, you know, it's Amazon Prime, so shipping was free. What the heck, and I'm glad I bought it. It was a good sale price. I think I bought it for like $35 and it was normally $50 or something. So,
yep. And I've been pretty happy with just the little Belkin power
strip
that I have. 3 outlets, 2 USB, both the USB are 2 amp USB.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah. So there's an older version and a newer version of that same Belkin one. If you go on Amazon, make sure you grab the newer version. It costs, last I checked, $3 more.
Okay.
It's already, I think, one version's 14 and the other 17. But you definitely, if you have a full-size tablet, you want the 2-amp.
Yeah, you really want to be careful when you buy those power strips with the USB ports. I know, not so much being careful in my case, but I bought the first generation Belkin years and years ago when they first started, you know, coming out with power strips with USB ports on them. And this one, I didn't look at the time is the problem. I wasn't careful. It was a 500 milliamp output. So basically, it hardly charges anything, even a phone. Especially modern phones, you know, which tend to be a little bit power hungry when they, John's holding it up.
Yeah.
It physically looks exactly like the one I have, except mine is limited to half an amp.
Yeah. And it doesn't help that if you actually look at them, they don't tell list. The model number is different and there's a very slight difference, aesthetically. I have the other one over here too, somewhere, but yeah, they look exactly the same. So. Yeah. Curse you, Belkin. I don't know why you made the better version look exactly the same as the other one. Just change a color or something and help us out so that we know we get the right chargers.
Right, right. Okay, so that's pretty much our travel series last couple of weeks. I see you have, you know, we have show notes when John and I do these things, so we kind of know what we're talking about. Not always, but it's kind of. And John notes that
through the same territory.
Yeah, John notes that there's a rumored, right? It's not set in stone. There's a rumored Apple event rumored to be scheduled for September 9th.
Good rumor at this point. I don't think it is set in stone, but it's a pretty good rumor.
Did it come from John Gruber? Then it'd be, you know, set in stone.
Yeah, it's something around those levels. It's being reported definitely everywhere.
Okay.
Everyone assumes this is new iPhones. That's completely consistent. Sure. New iPads is the question mark. This might be a refresh of the existing iPads. This might be the unveiling of a rumored iPad Pro, although many have said that could be its own event later in the year. Obviously, Apple has been known to run, in fact, they did this last year, an iPhone unveiling and then an iPad unveiling later in the year.
Right, separately.
So, and this is also probably the new Apple TV, which I'm definitely going to be picking up. If it was a new iPad Pro, I would definitely pick that up too. New iPhones, I think I'm going to wait another year for an iPhone.
Oh, I'm definitely going to wait for an iPhone. I'm on a tick cycle, so I guess you buy everything generally, but I'm on a, you know, there's a TikTok, right? So there's like a 4, 4S, 5, 5S, 6, and presumably a 6S. And I've never bought the S's. I've always bought the tick, not the talks.
Yeah, I always had the, when I didn't have an iPhone as my primary phone, I always bought the S's. Because I figured I wanted the last phone of that generation. Mm-hmm. So I have a 3GS over here. I have a 4S. And then when I switched to Verizon, I got the 5, skipped the 5S. I have the 6. And I think I'm going to skip the 6S for sure.
Yeah.
Because I'm on contract as well, which Verizon is no longer going to be offering.
Yeah, that's stopping, what, on the 15th?
13th or something like that. So what are you hoping for at this Apple event?
Well, you know, it's funny. All these months, this is sort of like the Apple Watch is rumored, and then it was announced. I don't want to get an Apple Watch. It's too darn expensive. So all these months, I've been saying, I have not bought an iPad in a long time. I've got an iPad 2, not an iPad Air 2. I've got the iPad 2 that was released in 2011. That's my main large format iPad. Works great, despite being, 4 years old now. I have the iPad Mini, the original, which was released, I think, in 2011. So it's, 4 years old or 3 years old, whatever. And they both work pretty well. However, neither of them are going to support the true multitasking, multi-screen options that will be in iOS 9. Or, is that right? Are we not going to be in iOS 9?
Yep.
And so, I really would like to get a new iPad. And for months now, I've been saying, John, I'm waiting for the iPad Pro, and that's what I'm going to buy, gosh darn it. but this is what happened. I don't go to very many large conferences anymore. In fact, this is the first one I've gone to, a week-long conference in probably a couple of years now. And I used the heck out of my iPad Mini. Mm-hmm. And the reason I used the heck out of it, because it was so easy to carry from session to session in a very large venue in the San Diego Convention Center. And, you pop it out, take photos of the screens, type in my notes. We had no tables, this was just, in your lap, just holding it in the seat. And it was great. And it reminded me why I liked the iPad Mini so much, to begin with, because it really got around a lot of the size issues, if you will. And it's all relative, right? But of a full-size iPad, which is, a little bit clunky to carry around when you're moving around literally every 45 to 70 minutes. And so I began to wonder, maybe I don't want a 12-inch iPad Pro, which is nearly twice the size of my iPad Mini. That's going to be, very different. Well, maybe not. Maybe carrying a notebook around, an Ultra. I don't know. I'm going for an announcement. If iPad Pro is announced, and if it is the only device that supports multi-screen multitasking, right? So both split screens can be active at the same time, then I'm probably going to buy one of those. However, for iPad Mini has the A8 or A9 or whatever processor is announced with it that's powerful enough to run it, I might go for another Mini. What about you?
Well, I have, as we've noted, so I just realized that I just buy all the latest Apple stuff and you just spread your money around to different things.
Yeah.
You have the Android and the Windows stuff covered. I really need a device that can change the screens. Like, I need to be able to resize my screen just like I resize Windows on my computer. Because I have the 6 Plus that I carry on. That's actually what I use at conferences. It's good just point. The iPhone 6 Plus.
Yeah.
Because I can tap out notes on that, and then I'm one of the few people not carrying around a giant something with them at hotels.
Right.
Then I use the iPad Mini for reading. And most of my media consumption is on the iPad Mini. I use the full-size iPad for work and also a couple of recreational things where I need to see a big screen when I'm lecturing and things like that. And I would get an iPad Pro just because sometimes the full size of the iPad isn't quite big enough when I'm glancing down at it, something like that. I want to be able to see a little more. So for me, I carry around a lot of devices. I do think I make good use out of them. But, I definitely agree that you have to use the right device for the right room. And so conferences, Yeah, you don't want necessarily to be carrying around the giant device. I remember seeing people at one of the conferences I go to a number of years ago with tablet PCs. And they, you know, they could take notes and they could do everything they needed to do. But the tablet PC was quite huge for them to be lugging around when most people just wanted to lug around a pen and a little notebook or something like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, your point about the iPhone 6 Plus being, you know, nearly the size of iPad Mini, it's, you know, I don't know, it just seemed easier for me to see, especially mm-hmm. when I was resizing photos on iPad Mini, which is, you know, only slightly larger, but still, it was just slightly large enough to make a difference. I need to really think about this. You know, I may just act on impulse and buy a Pro because I would really like a... Especially if they come out with a good keyboard for it. Because I was using a Microsoft Universal Mobile Keyboard, which is a Bluetooth keyboard, with my iPhone 6 Plus while I was on traveling for email and things. It was great. Really enjoyed using that.
One of the other things with the Pro that is rumored is the possibility it could have a stylus. This is something that Steve Jobs would have never gone for in a million years.
Yeah.
But with the new direction of Apple after his departure, I wonder if that would happen. So if it had a stylus, would that lock it in for you, or would you not care so much?
You know, it's an interesting question, and I don't know. I would say this, though. If the iPad Pro is wildly expensive, mm-hmm. and you know, iPads tend to be fairly expensive, you know, once you get to the 64 gigabyte and larger range, and anything smaller to me is not worth it.
Yeah,
I would look at the Surface 3, which, you know, comes with, what, 128 gigabytes of storage at $499.
Yeah, that is true.
I would have to buy a keyboard, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, Costco and those kind of places have deals all the time with a stylus and keyboard included for, you know, $600 or whatever. So Apple needs to look behind them because the race is afoot and they are not far that far out anymore.
Yeah, well, we shall. We still have quite a few weeks away to see what rumors develop for this event. Today, as we speak, it is the 8th of August, so we've got about a month to figure out what we think we're going to see, and then I'm sure we will discuss it ad nauseum once it happens.
And I should also note that although Windows 10 is still not a good tablet environment as the iPad or even Android tablets, having Windows 10 on a tablet with a keyboard is a very good experience. I'm really enjoying my Asus T100 again. Mm-hmm. And I had not been enjoying it with Windows 8.1. but anyway, I have more on that in a little bit. This is a very long podcast. But in any case, John, you wanted to know something about my Moto 360 experience?
I want an update because I haven't had a chance to listen to both the podcasts. I listened to a little bit of them while I was gone. But real quick, how are you feeling about the 360? You've had it about 3-4 weeks.
Yeah, I'm wearing it as we speak. I haven't thrown it against a wall in frustration or anything like that. I feel like I got a good value for, you know, $150 from Amazon. I had to do things like I had to uninstall the Evernote applet for it because it turned out that it was truncating files, existing files, not new files, existing files on my in my Evernote storage randomly, apparently. Fortunately, I have Evernote Premium, so I was able to recover fairly easily using Evernote history. Thank you, Evernote support, by the way, for pointing it out to me since I never used it before. But the native stuff works great, and by that I should say that really notifications. That's all I really want. That's all I really need. The other gravy. I did use Google Maps on my watch while I was wandering around San Diego on foot. That was pretty handy. It wasn't perfect, you know, because it wasn't. Maybe it was because it was tethered to my Nexus 4, whose GPS is not quite as good as the iPhone 6. But it got me to where I wanted to go. I mean, I pretty much knew where I needed to go, and I was just kind of using it as a test case to see if it was actually accurate enough, if I actually followed directions versus, you know, just going on my own and knowing where things were. But the notifications have been great. It's like having my spot watch again. You know, I know when I get messages and mail and things like that. The one thing I am having problems with is that the Moto 360, and it may be unique to the Moto 360 first gen, is it reboots it. It rebooted all by itself just after the doors closed on my airplane. you know, and basically right after they said turn off all the radios. And so I had to and it rebooted to the time zone that I have no idea where it was. And so my time was off for an entire 5.5-hour trip, which, you know, is infuriating. Every, you know, it turns itself on and you look at time and you realize, is that like some random time period? And then for some reason, just a few days ago, I'm using a watch face that won the Motorola's little contest called Pascual, named after the guy who designed it. Beautiful watch design. One of the neat things about it is the rings around, you know, where you have your like an analog watch rings. It would show in accent color when you have appointments scheduled. So, you know, from the inner ring would be for AM and outer ring for PM or something like that. Well, that stopped working a few days ago, and I have no idea how to turn it back on. So, little weird things like that. But that said, other than that, I really, really am enjoying using, not only enjoying using, but because I have a hard time feeling the phone vibrate, and I usually do have it on vibrate mode versus ring, because when phones ring in random places, just drives me crazy. So I figured I shouldn't do that to other people. Or feel the vibration of the phone. It's, you know, on my hip holster kind of thing. Having it vibrate on my arm, which I always do feel, is really great. So I don't miss, you know, calls or notifications of text messages from my daughter, you know, whatever it is. So that's been great.
What the smartwatches give you that I think people don't realize with notifications is just knowing, is this important enough for me to actually look at right now, or should I just not care? And, you know, you get a notification. A lot of people, I think, mistakenly think that when they get these notifications, it's going to be extremely distracting because they're then going to look at them. No, you spend a half a second, you look at it, go, I don't care about that. And you go back to what you're doing. And then you have that peace of mind that there's not a bunch of important things waiting for you on your phone. But you're not a slave to it. I think some people wrongingly get the impression that they're going to become phone junkies. And there were certainly some reviews of the Apple Watch that made it out like that, where people weren't aware that it was just kind of a novelty when they first started using it, that they would always check every notification and read it completely.
Yeah. You know, and to support your point, and just the other day, you know, about, you know, a couple of weeks after I got my watch, I was stopped at a red light. And my watch buzzed, and I looked down at it, and I saw basically it was just a press release, right? Just some PR-type person sending anything. Normally, you know, my phone would buzz. I'm going, what the heck is that? And I'd be tempted to, which is illegal to do here, by the way. And I'd be tempted to look at my phone, which, you know, I'm not supposed to do. Now, you know, I just kind of, you know, I stopped at red lights. I just looked at my watch, PR press release, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, not to worry about it. And so, red light turned green, and I drove without wondering what the heck that buzz was.
Yeah, if anything, it could keep you less distracted than more, because you're not wondering, oh, that was weird. I normally don't get anything, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
I'm glad to hear that your Moto 360 experience is going well.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, you're breaking up, but I'm not sure why. I don't know if it's your connection or mine or something else.
I'll just turn off my video that we don't record anyway for the listeners.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll do it as well. The question that I had, or the thing that I wanted to bring up about wearables, I published an article this week talking about hiding your Apple Watch in plain sight.
Okay.
I jokingly thought it should be titled "How to Turn Your $1,000 Apple Watch into a $1.95 Piece of Junk." But there are some tips I give in there where if you are going to an area where you might not want to advertise that you're wearing a smartwatch, or you just want some flair in a sense. So, for example, one of the things I bought was for $10 on Amazon. I found these little bumper cases that go around the watch. And on Fridays at my school, it's Go Green Fridays. Green and black are our colors. Mm-hmm. So I thought, you know, I could put a black watch band on. I have a few of those and a green bumper. And then I have my green and black, and that looks kind of nice. So whether you're camouflaging your phone, your smartwatch to keep it safe, or you just want some really cheap ways to customize the Apple Watch, and I'm sure these things exist for the other wearables as well. I've got some ideas and a very short article about that and how it kind of looks and all.
Okay, and I'll put
that sort of thing.
I'll put the entire link, the direct link, in the mobileviews.com blog. But if you want to find it, you know, before you have a chance to go look at the blog, mobileviews.com, just go to John Westfall, JohnWestfall.com, and I'm sure you can find it by scrolling down somewhere.
Yep, it's right on the first post right now up there.
Yeah. Okay, now, I just wanted to mention two quick things before we sign off on a long podcast, and that's two articles I published over at ExtremeTech.com this past week. One was an overview of the Windows 10 Phone Companion app, which, when it was first announced in March, I kind of just poo-pooed it as a wrapper to links to the existing mobile apps for the iPhone, Android, and of course Windows Phone. But as I looked at it more and more, I saw it in a much more positive light, especially if you, like John and me and probably yourself, as a power user, you're probably supporting friends and family, trying to get them help when they want to connect their phone to the rest of the world because they're probably not backing up and that sort of thing. And you mm-hmm. know what? If you have a friend who uses Windows 10 and has an Android iPhone or Microsoft, I couldn't even remember the name, Microsoft phone.
You've got that phone made by the Windows people. Yeah. What do they call that again?
Yeah. It should be. But in any case, it is a really nice way for them to learn about what is available, at least in the Microsoft ecosystem, that they can use to, you know, back up, listen to music, you know, back up their photos, whatever the case might be, as well as alert them to new apps as they become available. For example, Cortana will become available for Android and iPhone in the near future. I think the beta is already out on Android. But, you know, if they use Windows 10, and I know not everybody does yet, but if they use Windows 10 and they also have some kind of smartphone, it is a good way for you to help them and help yourself by reducing your tech support phone calls with your friends and family. By just saying, hey, you know what, if you got Windows 10, just use the app. It's already installed at Windows 10. You don't have to download anything. And it will point them out to everything, and it will even lead them through the process of plugging in the phone via a USB cable and using that to copy files back and forth, which you can do without the app, by the way. But the app just kind of helps them, learn, know that it's possible, and B, kind of stepped in through the process. So I really recommend recommend to your friends, your non-power user friends and family, Windows 10 phone companion app. And it's not just for Windows Phone. It is also for iPhone and Android. So very helpful.
I will remind people as well that if you are sucked into being tech support for your power non-power user friends, remember TeamViewer.com is free for personal use. It is still, I think, the gold standard in being able to remotely connect, and all you have to do is tell someone, hey, go download this and give me the code and the password, and I can help you out. So if you can't get them to help themselves, at least save yourself some trouble and look at TeamViewer. Right. Which is not sponsoring this or anything. I just think it's a really cool product.
Yep, you've mentioned it before, and I've used it as well, and I agree with you. And the last of the two articles I published this week over at Extreme Tech is not a review, but kind of an overview of, you know, at least two different apps that take slightly different approaches to the idea of 360-degree movies. And really, it's not 360. I just couldn't think of a better word. Really, it's spherical movies. If you've ever been at Disney World, that's where I first saw, I think Disney calls it Circle 360. Mm-hmm. You go in a circular theater and you can look around yourself and I think above too. So when a jet flies above you, I think in a Canadian pavilion at Disney World, you can literally look behind you, hear the jets, and watch as it passes overhead. And these two apps, one is from Google itself. It actually used to be the Motorola Spotlight Stories or something, and now it's Google Spotlight Stories. It's a free app, just recently made available for the iPhone. It's been available for Android for a little while. But what's really neat is the previous 360 movies available for it were all animation, which is, you know, great. I love animation. But they have a free live-action 5-minute movie, you know, if you want to call it, or short feature. By Justin Lin, and if that name sounds sort of kind of familiar, it's because A, he did, I think, 4 or 5 of the Fast and Furious movies, and he's also going to be the director of the next Star Trek movie. So, you know, he's got some cred, right, as a director. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of a fun little 5-minute piece, but I've got some questions about not his directorial ability, but the genre, despite being 50, 60 years old, I think the first 360 movie is introduced in 1955. Despite being 60 years old, we still don't have a language of how to direct these things quite yet. So things will be happening behind you, but you don't know it because you can look all around in this world. And like in a real world, you're not always paying attention to what's important. Whereas in a regular movie, the director tells you what to look at, right? Look ahead. Whatever's going to happen is going to be right in front of you. That's not the case in 360 movies. So, you know, a lot of times you'll hear like an explosion or something. Where's the explosion coming from? So you're turning around and, you know, it uses an accelerometer and the compass so you can physically turn around. I did it on a swivel chair to make it easier. You can also use your finger if you don't want to or if you cannot swivel around. So you can check that out. That is free. And the second app is from Roddenberry Entertainment, which is the family of the late Gene Roddenberry, who created Star Trek. And it's called White Room 02B3. It is a 15-minute feature that is, uses a different... It's also live action, but unlike the Justin Lin movie called Here, or no, Help. Not to be confused with the Beatles movie Help. Unlike where he uses green screens and live sets and, you know, different sets, this is all in a single room, perhaps not unlike some of the old Twilight Zone episodes, you know, that took place in a single room or nearly a single room. And everybody's on around a circular table, and it's literally a white room, and they wake up and they wonder where they are and what's going on. And I won't put any spoilers for you, but the problem, as interesting as it was... the problem is it doesn't move out of that room. In fact, it doesn't even move off of that center of the table. So you're always looking for the center of the table, which is, you know, if you are a live theater person and, you know, it's a one-set story, okay, that doesn't bother you. But for those of us who grew up with, you know, Mission Impossible and Star Trek and Jurassic Park and, you know, things change and scenes change, it's not quite as compelling, I think. And I had a question out to the Roddenberry Entertainment about whether or not they're going to try to... try to put this 360 camera on a, you know, on a moving vehicle or something, you know, like Google Street Car, and give us some different sets. I haven't received a response for that, so I just went ahead and published the article without a response. But both worth checking out. The Roddenberry app is $2.99. And full disclosure, they did give me a free copy. It's a whole $3 app, but I was too cheap to buy it for a review. but it is an interesting app. I really, you know, I like 3D, so maybe I'm odd. And I know a lot of people don't like 3D movies. I like 3D movies. I want
You're
to
odd,
like this,
but yeah. But not just for that purpose. Yeah.
I really want to like this 360, but I think we really need filmmakers to develop a language to inform the viewer what they would really like us to do, with the understanding that what you really want to be able to do, you know, for the viewer is after you tell them the story, they have them review the story from different angles to get a different, literally a different point of view of the story. And I think maybe the answer is maybe there's not just one story, you know, in the way we have in traditional movies. Maybe there are two or three stories. It's just that you have to look at it from literally different angles of the same scene. Kind of like if you smushed Kagemusha, I think, which took 4 points of view, I forget. But maybe if you did that, instead of doing it one after another in serial fashion, if you did it in parallel, but you just have to look at it, you know, look in the left for 10 minutes, and then the next time you look on the right, and you get different versions of the story from different characters' perspectives. I think that might be an interesting way to use 360, but that's not what's been done so far as I can tell anyway. It's still a single point of view. Okay, so that was the last I have to say for a very long Mobile Views 126. John, you got anything to add before we sign off?
It's good to be back.
It's good to have you back, my friend.
To not be forgotten, and it's good to be here, and I won't be traveling for at least a month, so we can get some more episodes in and maybe get some of our friends back on a little bit.
Yep.
And definitely keep an eye on what's going on with... Apple and this fall as we gear up toward, it's scary to say, the holiday season again. I'm sure we'll see some interesting tech stuff going on with that.
And not to sound like a Microsoft fanboy, but keep an eye out for the new Windows 10 devices. I think I'm supposed to get a loaner from Acer of the new Cloudbook, which is kind of their Chromebook competitor, which I'm really looking forward to seeing. It's a sub-$200 device for the 11-inch model, and I think it's like $300 or so for the 14-inch model. I'm really looking forward to seeing what Microsoft and Acer can do to compete with the Chromebook, which I don't know is all that popular, but I certainly know people who really like it. And certainly the management features where you don't have to worry about viruses and that sort of thing. So anyway, hopefully I'll get that on loan in the next week or two or three. And I'll probably be publishing that. Probably I will be publishing something at streamtech.com with photos and things. And John and I can discuss it here. So 126 Mobile Views Podcast. Bye, folks.